Great. Welcome. Welcome. Yeah. Thank you for being here. So I'm Ann Pasternak, and I am truly excited to be here because, you know, for a long time, it's been our dream at Creative Time that we would have an event that would honor artists, not because they're hot and groovy and party animals, but because the work they do is important, because the work they do is powerful, because the work they do is shaping history. And so here we are at last at that moment, and what better place to be inspired by these artists and to learn about their work than the venerable New York Public Library, a place of extraordinary knowledge and place for curiosity and introspection. And I'm especially proud to be here because we got to work with our friends from Live, from the New York Public Library, an incredible program that doesn't only just wake up those lions on the front of Fifth Avenue, but makes them roar. And in particular, I want to thank our friend Paul Holdengrauber. Paul, where are you? Wave hello. Yay, Paul. So, I hate speaking at podiums. Can you tell I'm really nervous? So, I want to tell you, you know, one of the dearest board members at Creative Time, someone that we all love a lot, Thelma Golden, once said at a board meeting, "There isn't a door that artists shouldn't kick open." Right? Do we all agree? Raise your hand. There's a few of you who didn't raise. We're going to talk about that later. Nato, you have to get on that. So I actually completely agree with Thelma, and I think that there isn't a door that artists shouldn't kick wide open. But in my 20-plus years as a professional in the art world, it's been really interesting because I think we're maybe in the minority. And I hear a lot of things that somehow or other it's maybe taboo for artists to participate in democracy. Can you imagine such a thing? And in fact, you hear a lot of things, I'm sure you've all heard it, like political art is bad art. Well, first of all, I gotta ask you, what art is not political? Are artists existing in a vacuum? Are they not a part of their times? Or maybe some people say political art isn't art at all. Did you ever notice that people have an idea of what isn't art, but if you ask them what art is, they could never answer that? It's really kind of astounding. And so I don't really think that the question for us is whether artists should be engaged with timely social matters that are important to us, but the question is, why wouldn't they be? Why wouldn't we be supporting artists and the expressive nature of humankind to engage with the important topics of our times? Why wouldn't artists be contributing to society in creative ways and making for a more just society? And so that's why we're all here tonight and tomorrow. We have at Creative Time been inspired by many artists over the years who are really trying to shape history and to make a difference in people's lives. And we simply just wanted to share some of those artists with you. We could have actually had this conference for weeks and weeks because there are so many artists, but Paul said no. And so it's Paul's fault. And so we're just starting what we hope will be the first of many of these summits in the future. And we're kicking off the summit. Oh, I forgot, I have a few slides to show you. So the idea of art and social change is not unfamiliar to Creative Time. We've always partnered with artists in responding to the times, especially things that are important to us, including moments of tragedy. We love when artists encourage us to think deeply about the times in which we live. And we are, of course, hoping that this will be a weekend that inspires you to think deeply as we introduce to you artists from around the globe. Okay, that's it for my slides. So, we're kicking off the summit tonight with a very important event. It's the launch of our inaugural Lenore Annenberg Prize for Art and Social Change. And the artists that have been selected for this prize are really great at making things happen. Now, happen seems like a very kind of innocuous word, but it's become an important word to me because last spring, artist Jeremy Deller, how many of you know who Jeremy is? Pretty good. All right. More of you will know about him later. He said to me, "I went from being an artist who makes things to being an artist who makes things happen." And then all of a sudden, I fell in love with the word happen. And these artists that we're honoring tonight are artists that make things happen all the time in really shocking, profound, and I think quite brilliant ways. And we're going to hear more about them later. But first, I want to tell you a little bit about the prize's namesake, Lenore Annenberg. So, truth of the matter is, Lenore Annenberg embodies the ideals of this prize. While her husband, Walter Annenberg, as I'm sure you all know, was the ambassador to the United Kingdom, Lenore joined him in ambassadorial duties and also created the Art and Embassies program, very important program. And together they built the Annenberg Foundation. Who here could not know about the Annenberg Foundation, as it's one of the most important foundations on the history of the planet? And their support of public education, democracy, humanitarian causes, and of course culture are globally renowned. But what you also probably know is that Lenore Annenberg was an incredibly adored and respected person. The kinds of words that people use about Lenore Annenberg all the time were charming, gracious, beautiful, intelligent, curious. But she, great, you know, she was honorable and generous. I said all of those things, I think. Warm and caring, energetic and fearless. She was fearless. But above all, Lenore Annenberg was devoted to public good and our democracy. She was a true humanitarian. In fact, Prince Charles recently said about her, Lenore Annenberg is the global citizen. That is high praise in my esteem. She's committed to civil discourse and the advancement of democracy. And Lenore Annenberg believed, and rightly so, that individual acts of goodness could reshape the world and make profound things happen. She believed it was our duty as citizens to right that which was not right. And she talked the talk, but she also walked the walk. And in the process, her life brought about profound goodness throughout the world. And tonight's bestowal of the Lenore Annenberg Prize for Art and Social Change specifically honors artists who embody her passion and her beliefs. The prize does more than give some much-needed cash to some artists who are doing some radical work, then helps them further their next projects, but it also recognizes the importance of art and artists in society. And it applauds artists who break new ground and shape history. So I was thrilled when our jury, who are all here tonight, of respected artists and arts professionals, selected unanimously the Yes Men to receive this award. These are artists who have committed their lives to radical acts of goodness, to right wrongs, and to inspire good. How many of you have seen their current film, The Yes Men Fix the World? How great is that film? Yeah, woo! I love that film. And it's aptly titled, as the collaborative duo really does work to fix the world. They mobilize others to do the same, and they show millions of people just what real change could look like, and pretty easily, they make it seem. So we are greatly, profoundly grateful to the Yes Men for being here today, and we're thrilled that you've all joined us. And I just want to thank a few people before I introduce you to Nato Thompson. And so first, I want to acknowledge the Creative Times staff. They are awesome. So Creative Times staff members, can you stand up? I think they're all in the back. They already were standing up. I love you guys. You're awesome. And I have a fantastic board. So the Creative Time board, wave your hands. Thank you very much. This is a board that's incredibly artist-centered, that really trusts us and supports all of our dreams. And I also want to acknowledge the sponsors for tonight. Have any of you been to the New Standard Hotel? There's a few of us. More of you have to go. Well, you know then, John, right, that the artists who are staying at the Standard Hotel are quite spoiled right now. They feel like the stars that they should feel like they are. And so we're very grateful to our hotel sponsor. And I also want to give a big shout out to the Lambent Foundation. They have been fantastic supporters of this conference, and we're very grateful to this foundation that really gets that art and social change can go hand in hand. So thank you to Lambent and Dalmas and all of our donors who make the work that we do every year possible. And most of all, I want to thank the Annenberg Foundation for their support of this evening and this prize. They're fantastic, and a most heartfelt appreciation goes to a wonderful young woman a board member trustee of Creative Time who, much like her grandmother, is beautiful and gracious and a humanitarian and intelligent and curious and profoundly good. And that is our very own Elizabeth K. Cabler, who we call Lizzie, and her mother, Elizabeth R. Cabler, who we call Elizabeth. And so you're going to meet them later, and I'm excited that you will. But right now, it is my honor to introduce you to a man I'm wildly crazy about, my chief curator, Nato Thompson.
All right. So this is an award ceremony. It's hard to not get into a cliche of the Academy Awards. I've watched it so many times, I've never been at an award ceremony, so this is cool. I'm going to start. Okay, so I'm a chief curator. I got to talk about history. So I'm going to start with Plato. Let's take it back. So Plato, as many of you might know, is really unpopular in the art world because the art world skims books. There's a skimming book kind of culture. And he's actually only known for saying one thing, really, in the art world. He's kind of known ignominiously as the Jesse Helms of antiquity. Because he's a man that said artists should not be allowed in the Republic, right? This is one of his defining things in the arts. Everyone's like, what? What is this? Everybody reads this book? Now, it's not that Plato was thinking about the yes men, right? Plato wasn't thinking, I don't want to survive a ball on the steps of the Acropolis. That's dangerous. And it's, you know, he's not shaking in his shoes and his toga, worrying about the management leisure suit and whether it fits him right. This is not one of his concerns. What Plato really was worried about was speech. He was worried about how does one get politics done when you can't talk to each other. He realized that artists play with metaphor, allegory, hyperbole, if not outright lies, to get their point across. And he thought, my gosh, you know, how are you supposed to talk if people are acting this way? What Plato never imagined was the contemporary media structure. The entire mouthpiece for politics that he had imagined became the artist he feared. That is to say, the movement against meaning is the way in which we actually talk as a nation. So the artist that Plato feared now is now the person that has to rectify the deep structure of deception. That's story number one. That was a fun one. All right, story number two. I'm really into Facebook. And if you have a friend that's not into it and they're kind of reluctant, tell them they're like those people that weren't into cell phones. And we're all going to get in. We're all going in. Just get in. Anyways, my new thing is that I love people posting videos, right? I could watch cats falling off stuff for days. And I got a clip this last week because the Yes Men have been out there. I don't even know if they've multiplied or what, but they've been doing a hijink or two a day. For the last 2 weeks, they're clogging my inbox. And the one I liked the most was they were at the Chamber of Commerce recently. And they held a press conference in D.C. as the Chamber of Commerce, announcing that they were reversing their position on climate change, that they were, in fact, going to support the Kerry Boxer bill. Now, this person represented them was, in fact, Andy Bickelbaum, taking on the identity of Hingo Sembra. If we do a question and answer, I don't know if we're going to do questions, but if we do, please, let's get to the source of these names. Hingo Sembra. And Hingo Sembra is up there. And he says, basically, you know, it's Chamber of Commerce admits its errors. You know, this position that the government should not regulate basic carbon emissions from industry is ludicrous. We've reversed that position. In fact, we will support the Kerry Boxer bill. And then a man walks into the room. And his name, unfortunately for him, is Eric Volschlegel. Which might strike you as a pseudonym as well, but the poor man is in fact Eric Volschlegel. And he says, this event is a fraud. This man behind the podium is a fraud. I, Eric Volschlegel, do in fact represent the Chamber of Commerce. Please direct your questions to me. He's a big guy, clearly a frat guy, used to doing this kind of stuff. The beer is mine. Please direct the beer to me, Eric Volschlegel. But anyways, so he's like commanding the room as a guy does, like him. And Higo Sembra looks at him and says, excuse me, in this kind of demure way, can I see your business card? And he says, my business card? Let me see your business card. And then an interesting argument ensues about business cards. No, let me see your business card. Let me see my business card. I imagine a Socratic dialogue in which, in order to speak, the person would say to the other, well, first, may I see your business card? And the other person would say, may I see your business card? And the person with the right business card would not, in fact, engage in a dialogue, but a monologue. Right? That is the contemporary version of the Socratic method. What is a business card? It's not just identity, right? It's identity attached to power. It says, I have the right to speak because my name is associated with this structure of power. That's how we speak now, right? It's about who's got the power. Well, that little moment kind of rattled our dear friend Eric Volschlegel. He came out of it a little shocked. And then the press turns on him and says, you know, come to think of it, Eric Volschlegel, I'm glad you're here to answer the questions. So is it true, then, that the Chamber of Commerce will not reverse their position on climate change and, in fact, is against government regulation of the environment? And Eric Volschlegel's eyes get big because, in fact, Eric Volschlegel didn't actually mean what he said. He didn't want any questions directed to him at all. Suddenly, Eric Volschlegel is holding an impromptu press conference. He basically says, well, our position is the one we took at the last press conference. Clearly unaware of the position they took at the last press conference. And he begins at that moment to crumble as the press direct questions at him. And then a moment emerges that I've seen in a film before. It's a film called Cat on a Hot Tin Roof with Burl Ives, Elizabeth Taylor, and Paul Newman, where Burl Ives, sickened by the painful selfishness of his family, begins to mumble the words, mendacity, mendacity. Well, Eric Volschlegel, confounded by his predicament, begins to murmur, audibly, fraudulence, fraudulence, fraudulence. And in fact, it suffices to say that fraudulence was the only word that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce uttered at their ad hoc press conference. The Yes Men, despite the fact that they're reluctant to admit it, are in fact artists. Most of the artists I like take on that term with a bit of hesitation because people are mutable today. They're not one thing. They move through a lot of stuff. But they're artists because they shape the world. They're not sculptors. They don't grab clay and they don't get there and they make their hands. This is how people think of art. And they don't get there with their paints and they sculpt the world by making a painting. For them, they realize that the world is forms, right? That the world itself, the form of politics, of communication, is a form that they meld with their hands. A press conference isn't just some abstract thing. It is a room with a podium, with flagpoles, with chairs, with a suit you borrow off somebody, and of course, business cards. These are the forms of communication. And this is how they use their arts, in order to infiltrate using the forms of politics. And they do this with fake websites, with weird costumes, with business cards, with suits, with press advocates, and press releases. In essence, their art form is them as what could be considered the court jester. Now, the court jester is the buffoon, right? It's the jokester who goes in and basically, because they're such idiots, their final joke is that they get to say the truth at the feet of the king who speaks only lies. So what's so funny about what the Yes Men say and the jester in history is that the truth is so obvious, the big joke is how it's so weird to hear, right? So when they dress up like HUD representatives down in Katrina-stricken New Orleans and say, hey, we're the Department of Housing and Urban Development, we're going to open up housing here. They're only speaking what should be an obvious truth that is perversely not. Or when they say that Dow Chemical is in fact going to pay for the tragedies that they've put upon all the victims of Bhopal disaster and basically reimburse the people who were hurt by this, this insane hoax is just the obvious thing to do. So in essence, what they do is they speak truth to power. And I'm so glad that we are here in this space to talk about truth to power. And not just tonight in this award, which is totally important. I'm so glad Creative Time and the Lenore Annenberg Foundation have stood up to basically support not artists because they're hot on the market or because, like, I don't know what parties they're going to, but because they're actually participating in the construction of history, the great modern project, in the kind of more productive vein. I think that's important. And tomorrow as well at the summit, this road to that is not easy. It's complicated. It's hard. But what binds everyone together is a commitment to the political urgency. And the yes men embody that they're not just making jokes for the sake of it, that there's in fact something on the line, that there is an urgency because there's bodies that are being hurt by power, because there's realities to it. So I'm so glad that they're getting this award. And speaking of truth to power, I want to hand the microphone now to someone I'm sure many of you are familiar with. She's the director of Democracy Now!, the radio station I listen to every morning and get so angry that I am incensed my whole subway to work. Just like this. Yeah. I know it. It's so true. And then I look at the New York Times sometimes. I'm like, what's this front page? I look at like the New York Post and I'm like, my God, what's happening? Anyways, and everyone's just like, this guy's got to calm down. I want to bring to the stage Amy Goodman.
Well, what an honor to be here and to be doing this in the New York Public Library. I see all libraries as sanctuaries of dissent. Well, Halloween is just around the corner, and the kids are going to be out in force saying trick or treat, right? Give me the candy or, well, you may be subjected to a prank. But the pranksters are already out in force, as you just heard the story of the Yes Men. And it's not just the Yes Men. There is so much happening right now. For example, you may have heard that in the Indian Ocean, the president of the Maldives held the world's first underwater cabinet meeting last weekend, demonstrating that rising sea levels could very soon overwhelm his archipelago nation. When the Copenhagen Climate Conference is less than 50 days away, people are stepping up the pressure. The president of the Maldives is named Mohamed Nasheed. When he held this underwater news conference with his entire cabinet in scuba gear, well, I think two of the people did not go underwater because they didn't know how to scuba dive. It's a new requirement for politicians now. They signed an SOS from the front line declaration, reading in part, if we can't save the Maldives today, you can't save the rest of the world tomorrow. They're carrying that declaration to Copenhagen. So that had just happened last weekend when we heard about the latest prank of the supreme pranksters, the Yes Men. Yes, that remarkable news conference in the National Press Club where they rented the press room and posed as representatives of the Chamber of Commerce. And, well, you heard about what they did in great detail, but it's really significant. I mean, to be doing it before reporters, but they're very much used to it, holding a legitimate press conference stating the Chamber's complete reversal in its historically adamant opposition to climate change legislation. So the day after they did this on Democracy Now!, how many of you listened to Democracy Now!? How many of you watched Democracy Now!? If you live in the city, you can watch it on CUNY TV every night on Manhattan Neighborhood Network, and you can video and audio podcast at democracynow.org. But we had the Yes Men on. We had Andy Bickelbaum on the next morning, showed it, and then he came on to talk about his prank. And afterwards, we had on a PR guy. We had on Jim Hogan, longtime PR man in Canada, who's just written a book called Climate Cover-Up. He's been doing PR for 30 years. And, you know, there's been a lot of comparisons of the Yes Men now to the Balloon Boy. You know, how are they any different? What about this hoax? What about these liars? And so I asked Jim Hogan, you know, he's a PR guy. This is his profession. This is who he mingles with. What does he think of what these guys did? And he was pretty straightforward on Democracy Now! He said the PR stunt wasn't pulled off by the Yes Men. The PR stunt is basically being pulled off by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and it's been going on for decades. Do you know how much they have been spending to affect climate change legislation, I should say, to eviscerate, to stop any kind of climate change legislation? Oil, gas, and coal interests are spending $300,000 a day lobbying the government. Well, the moment of climate change truth is upon us, and the professional deniers are up to their old tricks. But thank God we've got some pranksters who are up to some new tricks. And it's not just... They were not just born this week, of course. The stories of the Yes Men go back. In 2004, December, on the 20th anniversary of Bhopal, India, the disaster in which a Union Carbide plant gas leak killed thousands of people, Andy Bickelbaum of the Yes Men appeared on BBC News, posing as a representative of Dow Chemical, speaking from a French studio to the BBC broadcaster in London. His name was Jude Finisterra. Okay, end of the earth, Finisterra. But anyway, his name was Jude Finisterra, dead serious about this dead serious topic. You know, Dow Chemical had bought Union Carbide. By the way, they didn't go to BBC to ask to be on. BBC went to them. And this is how often how it happens. They set up a website, dowethics.com, and they got an email from BBC, would you be on this very important 20th anniversary? So they went into the studio. As a Dow Chemical spokesperson claiming Dow would finally take full responsibility for the accident, they had bought Union Carbide, they would liquidate Union Carbide and put the $12 billion, give it to the people of Bhopal. All of a sudden, you saw on BBC breaking news, as they realized what this Dow Chemical spokesperson is saying. And, you know, the hoax is revealed, and Dow Chemical is saying, you've got to take this back. BBC is taking back. The news has gone all over the world. And these guys don't stop. They also issue a press release, again as Dow, saying, okay, we do not apologize for what we did to the people of Bhopal. So let's advance a few years, if you could call it advancing. The Yes Men, Andy Bickelbaum and Mike Bonanno, address Canada's largest oil conference, posing as executives of ExxonMobil and the National Petroleum Council. They announce a plan to convert the corpses of the expected millions of victims of climate change into a fuel they call Vivoleum. They're ejected, after which Bonanno holds a news conference and says while ExxonMobil continues to post record profits, they use their money to persuade governments to do nothing about climate change. This is a crime against humanity. So it's picked up, of course, around the world, as was this news conference last week. You know, Dow, that was picked up by BBC. The last week's press conference, as it's all unfolding at the National Press Club, Fox Business News is going live with the announcement, and then CNBC is going live, Reuters is going live. So their work is accomplished by the networks that don't ask the questions. You know, a spokesperson for a corporation speaks, why question them? Of course, question the Yes Men unless you don't realize that they are the Yes Men. It is so important that we raise questions, and there's no better people to do it than all of you, than the artists and activists. I do a column every week to try to give a roadmap in the mainstream newspapers to people for alternative media, this universe of alternative ideas. And one of the first pieces I did was called the art of war and deception. And I started with a quote. Every great work of art goes through messy phases while it's in transition. A lump of clay can become a sculpture. Blobs of paint become paintings which inspire. No, this is not Pablo Picasso speaking, but Major General William B. Caldwell, the fourth spokesman for the multinational force Iraq, comparing the carnage in Iraq to a work of art in another audacious attempt to paint Iraq as anything other than a catastrophe. The general's remarks do bring the great artist, Picasso, though, to mind. His epic painting, Guernica, named after the city in Spain, captured the brutality of the bombing of the city during the Civil War, the Spanish Civil War. The painting, almost 30 feet wide, globally recognized depiction and artistic condemnation of war. Picasso showing the terror on the faces of the people, the frightened animals. He shows the dead, the dying, the dismembered. A tapestry reproduction of the Guernica is up at the United Nations. It adorns the lobby outside the United Nations Security Council. I don't know how many of you knew this. And in February of 2003, before then U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell gave his major push for war at the United Nations, remember that speech that he would later call a blot on his record, a blue curtain was drawn across the tapestry so that the image would not be the backdrop for the press statements on the coming war. Immediately, posters and banners of Picasso's Guernica began appearing at the anti-war demonstrations that were sweeping the globe. The attempted control of imagery and propaganda, language and spin has been a high priority in the past for the Bush administration. Yes, the Pentagon forbade photographing the flag-draped coffins of fallen soldiers, but the manipulation goes beyond the war. And I should say, unfortunately, President Obama has continued to try to withhold certain pictures, in this case, pictures of torture. He should not be an accomplice to what the past president did. It is not the images that are so offensive. It is that the act was done. And if he decries the act, he should not be afraid to show, to reveal, to pull back the curtains on what has been such a terrific stain on all of our history. The only way to clean it up is to expose it and then to move forward. But let's go beyond the war. We go back to President Dwight Eisenhower, who once said, every gun that's made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies in the final sense a theft from those who hunger and are not fed. Well, if Eisenhower worked for the Bush administration, he would have had to revise his statement recently. Well, they said when they were in office, they stopped using the words hunger or hungry when describing the millions of Americans who couldn't afford to eat. Instead of suffering from hunger, the Agriculture Department said these people were experiencing very low food security. Now, we got to tell things like they are. You know, I originally come from Pacifica Radio. Now, Democracy Now! Is on 800 public radio and television stations, but we started at Pacifica in New York. It's BAI. It's a 60-year-old network, begun when a man named Lou Hill in Berkeley, California, came out of the detention camps after World War II. He was a conscientious objector and said there's got to be a media outlet that is not run by corporations that profit from war, but run by journalists and artists. And that's how Pacifica was born. It grew to five stations, KPFK in Los Angeles, celebrating 50 years now, BAI in New York, about to be 50, Washington WPFW, the youngest station, and KPFT in Houston, born in 1970. That station's the only radio station in the country, the Houston station, whose transmitter was blown up. In the first year of operation, they had just gone on the air, and the Ku Klux Klan strapped dynamite to the base of the transmitter and blew it to smithereens. And when they got back on their feet, they blew it up again. Now, the silver lining of this, of course, is Pacifica didn't have any money to advertise the new station. It certainly blew it into the consciousness of the potential listeners of Houston. And I can't remember if it was the Grand Dragon or the Exalted Cyclops, because I often confuse their titles. But he said it was his proudest act. And I think that's because he understood how dangerous Pacifica is, how dangerous independent media is. Dangerous because it allows people to speak for themselves. And when you hear someone speaking from their own experience, whether it's a Palestinian child or an Israeli grandmother, whether it's an uncle from Afghanistan or an aunt from Iraq, it rings true. You do not have to agree. but you begin to understand it breaks down stereotypes that fuel the bigotry, that fuel these hate groups. We need a media in this country that builds bridges between communities, doesn't advocate the bombing of bridges. And that's the power of independent media. You know, I think the embedding process has brought the media to an all-time low. You know, reporters embedded in the front lines of troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm not saying the reporters aren't brave, but think about what are they going to get when you're covering the war from the trigger end, when you're sleeping with the troops, eating with the troops, when your life is in their hands, you bring one perspective. If you're going to have these reporters embedded there, you need reporters embedded in Iraqi hospitals and Afghan communities and the peace movement around the world to get the full implications of war. And the problem is not only being embedded in the military, it's being embedded in the establishment in Washington. How often you have these reporters, whether it was the Bush administration or the Obama administration, going to the White House news conference, all too often enjoying the access of evil. That's access of evil, trading truth for access. It's got to stop. Because we are journalists, and there's a reason why our profession is the only one explicitly protected by the U.S. Constitution, because we're supposed to be the check and balance on power. My brother and I wrote a book called Static, and the reason we call it that is because in this high-tech digital age, all we ever get in the media is static. That veil of distortion and lies and misrepresentations and half-truths that obscure reality. When we need the media to give us the dictionary definition of static, that's criticism, opposition, unwanted interference. We need a media that covers power, not covers for power. We need a media that is the fourth estate, not for the state. And we need a media that covers the movements that create static and make history. And I also think that's what artists do. Artists like Mike and Andy, artists who engage in, document what is happening in the world and reflect it back to us. How important that is. We need an honest, authentic media that's not brought to us by the war manufacturers, that's not brought to us by the food processors, the health insurance industry, that's not brought to us by the drug companies. We occupy a sacred space in society. And the reason we are protected and the reason we have to use that protection for social good. You know, I know artists here have done work in New Orleans. There was a very interesting example when Hurricane Katrina hit of the media doing the right thing. You know, the media embedded in the front lines of troops in Iraq. Well, when they went to New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina hit, something interesting happened. A side effect of President Bush, you know, not authorizing his administration to take care of the people, that we could see the drowning of an American city in this century is remarkable, this great cultural center. But a side effect of him doing nothing was that when the corporate media raced to New Orleans, there were no troops to embed with. And we suddenly saw an image that was unspun, reporters standing in the water. I remember a CNN reporter, a young woman, interviewing a man who was carrying his boy. He said his wife, her hand had just slipped out of his as she said, "Take care of our children." He turned around and walked off in shock with his child into the water, and the reporter started to cry. That's reporting from an unembedded perspective. That's reporting from ground zero. Could you imagine if for just 1 week we saw those images in Iraq and Afghanistan? We saw the babies dead on the ground. We saw the women with their legs blown off by cluster bombs. We saw the soldiers dead and dying. For just 1 week, Americans are a compassionate people. They would say, no, war is not the answer to conflict in the 21st century. Democracy Now.
Thank you, Amy. Amy, did you notice there's a competition? More people listen to Democracy Now! Every morning than have seen the Yes Men movie. Got a little competition. Thank you very much. And will you please come up? You guys are next.
Wow. Like many others, I seek to make my grandmother proud. I always have, and I always will. This award, given in her memory, is held close to our hearts, as she always championed giving back in creative ways. Her message clear as a mother, as a grandmother, as a humanitarian, and as a passionate philanthropist. She was always forward-thinking at the ripe old age of 90. She was still on her toes and able to see the importance and the need for an award to promote artists engaged in social change. She made this partnership and adventure possible, and we are so honored to be a part of this celebration of her spirit and of the creative community. I am also deeply honored to be the youngest board member of Creative Time and a part of the Creative Time family. It's changed my life. And I wanted to thank Ann Pasternak, whose forever original thinking got us here, and to thank the Yes Men for accepting this award, because they are truly profoundly important Mary Pranksters. And I hope I might be able to share some useful ideas until the ripe old age of 90 as well.
This is right. Maybe this. These are some. This is really humbling. These are some hard acts to follow. It's very humbling, especially to follow Amy Goodman, who's extremely important and a critical inspiration for so many people over the years. We've constantly learned from her and been inspired by her. Another way of saying that is that we've stolen from her. I remember sometime before the election, Amy said all too presciently that when Obama gets elected, he's going to face tremendous pressure from industrial interests of all sorts. And if he's sitting in a room, and this image really stuck, if Obama's sitting in a room with some big money types, he's got to be able to point out the window and see us in the streets and say, I'm really sorry, if I do what you're asking me, they're going to come after me with pitchforks, and I just can't do it, sorry. And that's the only way he'll be able to say no, all too presciently. And at the time, that inspired us to start working on a fake New York Times that would be published right after, it would be printed and distributed in Manhattan 1 week after the election. And it would be set 6 months in the future, full of stories that we would see if we actually did take to the streets. And the last Creative Time event that we spoke at, it was the Democracy Show at the Armory, and we solicited ideas from the audience and had NATO run from one side of the room to the other, And people came up with amazing stories, a lot of which entered into the newspaper. So we owe a lot to people who were there, to Creative Time, and in general to a whole lot of collaborators. These awards owe a lot to the people who have given us ideas, and to many people who have generously thrown ideas at us over the years. More to the point, it owes a lot to the collaborators who have been working with us. A lot of you are actually here tonight, and a lot more, of course, couldn't make it, and this award is actually for them. Yep. And as Nato said, we do resist the term artists, but we do like art. So we'd like to show some nice examples of art as we go along. The main thing we feel that this award is doing, besides helping us quite a bit, and it does help, we're distributing a movie, and that's hard. It sends a very clear message from Creative Time, one of New York's premier arts organizations, that artists needn't limit their sights to galleries. It's saying don't even bother looking at galleries. There's so much out there. There's a whole world. And boy, does that world need us. A week ago Thursday, the entire U.S. territory of Puerto Rico went on an unprecedented general strike. All state-owned enterprises shut down for the day. All of the island's colleges and schools closed their doors. And 100,000 people took to the streets to protest the plans to lay off 17,000 public employees in a further evisceration of the public sector. You didn't hear about it, right? We didn't either. We all heard about Balloon Boy instead. Last Monday, working in concert with a much smarter activist organization that shall remain nameless, we impersonated the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, as Amy and Nato described, and we threw a press conference. It took all of 3 days, actually, for us to arrange this with help from our friends. We reserved the room, bought an internet domain, set up a rudimentary website, and printed the chamber's logo on some cardboard that we hung from the podium. It was a ridiculously simple skit that any high school drama club could have pulled off with a bit of help from the geeks across the hall. And, of course, a lot of help from Mr. Volschlegel from the real Chamber of Commerce. We're not bragging, but our little skit, unfortunately, got more news than the entire U.S. territory of Puerto Rico going on a general strike. That's a terrible state of affairs, and it's got to change. Journalists who see important things going on in the world should be able to report on them just because they're important. And right now, they can't do that, with very few exceptions. For one thing, big corporations control the media, and the rebellion of a U.S. territory apparently doesn't sell papers. It's just not very upbeat. Worse, journalists and the media are constantly deluged with hoaxes, extremely expensive ones. The Chamber of Commerce that was our target on Monday has a quarterly lobbying budget of $37 million. That's about enough to put on 74,000 fake press conferences like the one we did on Monday. And actually, right now, they're sending out a press release to their members saying they're under attack from the Yes Men and they need help, financial help. It's true. And of course, $37 million is only the tip of the iceberg. Huge lobbying firms pump hundreds of millions of dollars into fooling the media, politicians, and all of us into thinking that they're not destroying the planet. Those hoaxes don't get revealed as hoaxes within 20 minutes, and they're the real pranksters on a massive scale, as Amy so aptly said. Stupidly enough, the only thing that can pretty reliably compete with those hundreds of millions of deadly corporate dollars are two things: artistic creativity and various other ways of figuring out to get crucial messages into the public eye. There are zillions of examples of ways to do that, but perhaps the most effective form of art that goes back quite a ways and that we Yes Men have lately gotten involved in promoting is the great art of civil disobedience. A high school skit with a piece of cardboard on a podium and a pretty well-timed email announcement can get a certain amount of press. But for real change to happen, we need to actually take to the streets. And the way to really get things changing is for waves upon waves of people to get themselves arrested. It's what helped end South African apartheid, made segregation a thing of the past, and so on and so forth. Ultimately, it's probably the only way that things can change for the better. It's great art. That's why recently, working with a group of direct action artist activist friends, we plagiarized from the 1980s Pledge of Resistance, which was about stopping the murderous U.S. war on Central America, and helped to set up a site called beyondtalk.net, or Climate Pledge of Resistance. It's very nicely designed by Daniel Dunham and Kelly Anderson, in fact, who are being pointed to. And it's, of course, and what it does is call for people to be arrested, pledge to be arrested, if necessary, in the name of pushing for good climate change policy. This piece is inspired by a truly great artist named Tim DeChristopher. Like so many great artists, he discovered his medium quite by accident. He headed to an auction of Utah public land to the oil and gas industry at the end of the Bush regime. It's a lot like an art auction, auction of land. It's people buy stuff, except here the collectors were collecting Utah wilderness in order to pepper it with holes to extract fossil fuels instead of collecting things to hang on their walls and resell for profit. So Tim went to protest it. He didn't want to stay outside. He wanted to go inside and cause a ruckus and get arrested because he felt that's how you make the point. So walked in the door, barged in, and the first thing that happened when he walked in the door is he was mistaken for a collector. Somebody said, "Are you here to bid?" And he said, "Why, yes, I am." He was handed an auction paddle and proceeded to win 12 lots of Utah wilderness in a row, after which the judge realized that something was amiss. He was dressed not quite as well as this, and shut down the auction. Tim was arrested, and the auction was put on hold. Then Obama took office and canceled the auction. So Tim, the artist, made a piece where he single-handedly saved all of that land from the dirty exploitation of a few big collectors. And that's great art. So to finish up with some urgings to action, you might consider sponsoring Tim DeChristopher, who's going to go on trial very soon and wants to put our inaction on climate change on trial, needs money to do it. You can visit bidder70.org to do that. Beyond Talk, of course, we've already told you about. Beyondtalk.net, where you can pledge, if necessary, to participate in direct action. A third great website is 350.org. And tomorrow, October 24th, is going to be perhaps the greatest art installation ever, and it'll be worldwide. Thousands of groups around the world are participating in this action to get the number 350 on the global view screen. 350 is the level in parts per million of carbon above which the atmosphere hasn't risen in 650,000 years. 350. Today, it's at 390. So much more carbon than we've ever seen. And scientists have no idea what's going to happen. But they know we're in serious danger, and we need artists to figure out how to get that message out there. The New York component of that, of this global art installation, will be at the Brooklyn Bridge at noon and at Times Square at 3 p.m., and we'll be at both places along with thousands of other artists. Obama won, and that's fantastic, but today we really need those pitchforks. The Capitol Hill plant stopped burning coal because of a massive direct action shortly after the election. Not much else, it seems, has really changed. The big banks still rule, imperial wars continue, mountaintops are still being exploded for fossil fuels, etc., etc. And the only ones that we have to blame for this state of affairs are artists for not doing enough. whatever your role in culture, get into the streets. Demand change by all the means at your disposal to expose the real criminals and stop trading the planet for a bit more short-term profit.
Thank you. Let's give a big round of applause for the Yes Men. Okay, right on. They're amazing. We're not going to do a big question answer. We have room for about four questions. I don't know how to choose ones. But if you have a burning question for these guys, I mean, let's face it, they're probably going to be in jail soon. So, Shane? Where's Superstar Shane? Do we have someone to run the mics here? Okay, check.
My question is that it's wonderful that you're focusing on climate change, and I don't expect one group to tackle every issue, but yesterday I was sitting with the head of an NGO that's part of many NGO networks for poverty eradication, and he was saying, well, how is it possible, again, that we could come up with the billions to bail out the banks, and we can't come up with a fraction of that, what's being asked for development for poverty eradication? And I'm wondering if there's any outreach or response or way for you and your colleagues to kind of get through to some of the major NGOs that actually are into mobilizing people but haven't quite gotten their act together in a powerful enough way to be the pitchfork force that we all agree is needed.
The way that we work is by collaborating with activist organizations. So if anybody out there is from an organization that cares about a specific issue, you can write to us or call us and we'll talk to you about coming up with a plan together. So we feel it's very important for whatever we do that has a kind of hit and run aspect. You know, we create a bit of a media spectacle that's usually there for a very short amount of time, and it has to work in concert with the deep needs of an organization that's doing the hard work of organizing. So, you know, let us know. We're all ears. Right now, climate change has become our major issue simply because it seems the issue of all issues. You know, if we don't fix that, then everything else gets worse. So that's the real reason why we're focusing on that, but we're totally willing to try whatever we can or to advise you on doing something yourself.
And if we don't answer your emails, it's because we're really busy, but you can go to challenge.theyesmen.org and we give away all our secrets. So you can just do it if that's what you want to do.
Hi, I think you're great. And there are artists doing things all over the city for 350.org, including me and people at Amy Lipton's and so on. I want to know, are you going to go to COP15? Are you going to go to the Global Warming Conference?
Thank you for asking. Yes, our movie is still playing at Film Forum, so please do go. It's really hard to get people to go see a movie. We have a crew that is going to grow itself there. We have one or two people who are going, three people maybe, and then we have a kind of posse of young sort of enthusiastic students who are ready to wear survivaballs and create a spectacle, mayhem, what have you. Try to focus some attention there.
Yeah. If you have any ideas for what we could do, we're all ears.
I do.
Oh, great. Great. Okay. Oh, great. Give us your... And incidentally, related to that, there are coupons at the front that you can use if you buy your ticket at Film Forum Theater. You'll get a free New York Times.
I got a question. In terms of your guys' relationship to the art community, because I know that often people use this word arts in a very vague, sweet way, but actually the activist political community has a very
I would say, tense relationship, which is to say that often the arts is, in fact, an annoying elitist community that has no care for the issues you're raising. And I often think to the culture wars, where the accusations that were used against the arts weren't entirely inaccurate, out of touch, snobbish, hates your everyday person. I was like, sounds like a lot of the arts to me. So, so that is to say, when you guys are ambivalent about this term artist, is that somewhere mixed up in there? And also, how do you unpack these complicated mythologies around the arts in terms of what you do? Because there's many communities that comprise the arts. And this is a big art audience, and we all wrestle with these issues here. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, we don't like to ruin our welcome before we've entered the room. And, you know, in the United States, especially with the culture wars, you know, when you call yourself an artist, to many people it means that you are elitist or that you basically are going to say something snobbish. And so we try to avoid identifying ourselves that way so that we are not perceived in that way. And it gives us a little more credibility. Believe it or not, calling yourself a comedian has more currency with most of the public than calling yourself an artist. If we go to Europe, though, we're like, yeah, we're artists, no problem. Because there's more of a tradition of kind of respect and authority that goes with being an artist. People listen to artists still. People care about art.
Like, if you're an artist who gets rejected from art school, you might go on to take over Europe.
We have an expanded definition of artist. You know, it's a label, it's a signifier, and we prefer to maintain some degree of flexibility. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, I think you did. I think it's important because it complicates a lot of... Because people are like, why don't they call themselves artists? And some people wear it with such a badge, and other people I know are very like... You know, Critical Art Ensemble had this phrase called, I'll call it art if that's what the grant application asks for. Which I enjoy thoroughly. But it embodies this kind of duplicity, if you will, or this kind of this shifting quality.
Yeah, it's not because we want to reject the term artists. It's because of the perception and trying to work tactically that we avoid the term. I mean, we could embrace the term artist with most of the people in this room, I think. I haven't read all of your dossiers, but I think it's okay for us to call ourselves artists here today.
Good. We could take two more questions.
Hello, I live in Minnesota, and I'm wondering if you've considered running for office.
Like that.
How many people are from Minnesota in the room? Let's hear it from Minnesota. Woo! Minnesota!
It's not so unusual where I come from, just so you know.
Right. I turned off my mic for that. Thank you. No. Yeah, we'll do that. Thank you.
Seriously? I'm serious.
We should. Tell us how. Work with us.
Not sure.
I think you fit very well in the art world tradition of bad boys, right? I mean, there is a tradition of being a bad boy. And being
naughty. Don't know about that.
Yeah, it's a good thing. It's a good thing. And what did Alan Capra say? He said, experimental art is that art that nobody knows is art. So, I mean, that's where it's at. And he also talked a lot about an artist named Poussimp, who ran for mayor of Rosendale, New York, and won and served as mayor, cleaned up their water quality issues for 2 years, didn't tell a soul he was an artist, and retired, and then afterwards was only exposed as an artist by Paul McCartney. So, I mean, you come from a great tradition. Be proud.
Thank you.
Thank you for that question.
Yeah. Okay, well, sorry, I'm just doing business over here with Anne. Is there any more questions from the audience? Okay.
Can I just say one more thing?
Yeah, totally.
I think one of the things that's also somewhat unclear, we did sort of thank our collaborators, but honestly, the Yes Men isn't just the two of us. We kind of are the public faces, but there are a lot of other people who really, you know, deserve the credit for this, and they couldn't fit on the stage, so we locked them in a closet before coming here. And I just wanted to thank them and to thank the Annenberg Foundation for this fine prize and you guys at Creative Time. So just, yeah.
Thanks, guys. And thank you to them. And thank you to everybody here. This is just the beginning of tomorrow. Is a full-day summit, as you know, where there's incredible artists, curators, critics coming together to kind of hash these things out. So I invite you to come out tomorrow. And again, thanks for being here, and thanks to the Yes Men.